Good morning, Central Iowa. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, your host for the next hour, and this is Local Talk, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa and the life of our community. Thank you for listening. Rain and thunderstorms are predicted for this afternoon and tonight, but after that, there's not much to say about the week, except clear skies with days in the 70s and nights dipping down into the 40s. Full moon tonight, although we may not be able to see it with cloudy skies. Maybe you saw it last night. It looked really beautiful. From what I see, the stink bugs are preparing for winter and figuring out all sorts of ways to get into the houses. Not something I enjoy so much about this time of the year. Don't like the stink bugs. Not a big fan. Now here's Dennis Hart with a summary of the news from this past week.
The coronavirus continues its ongoing march through Iowa. School districts return to mask mandates and our first look at possible new redistricting maps in the state. All made big news last week. First, the coronavirus. There was word last week that nearly 12,000 Iowans had tested positive during the previous 7 days, the most since January. More than 1,600 state residents were getting the virus each day, one about every 50 seconds. The week's number of new cases was 40% higher than it had been the previous week. And of those cases, about 3,400 were children, who once again were the age group with the most new cases. The total number of positive cases in the state since the pandemic started exceeded 463,000. In addition, 64 more coronavirus deaths were reported in Iowa, the most in 1 week since last April. That brought the total number of coronavirus-related deaths in the state to 6,401 since the pandemic started. And 578 people were hospitalized with the virus last week. Nearly 80% of them were not vaccinated. And 23 long-term care facilities in Iowa were reporting coronavirus outbreaks. Slightly more than half of all Iowans were said to be fully vaccinated as of last week. All this after a federal judge had temporarily blocked the enforcement of the state's ban on mask mandates last week, giving Iowa school districts the power to enact such mandates. In May, Governor Reynolds had signed the law that banned school districts and local governments from issuing mask mandates. The governor vowed to appeal the ruling, saying the state would, in her words, exercise every legal option to uphold state law and defend the rights and liberties afforded to any American citizen protected by our Constitution. The decision came in a case brought by parents of students with disabilities. And after that judicial ruling, a few school districts started imposing mask mandates. Among them, the Ames, Des Moines, West Des Moines, Urbandale, Cedar Rapids, Iowa City, and West Burlington school districts. And the Polk County Board of Supervisors adopted a new policy last week, one that says all county employees who do not provide proof of vaccination by the end of this month will be required to test for the coronavirus each week. Vaccinated staff who test positive for the virus will be granted up to 80 hours of additional paid sick leave. Meanwhile, Collins Aerospace in Cedar Rapids announced it will require workers to get vaccinated. About 9,000 employees work for Collins in Cedar Rapids. And late last week, a Federal Food and Drug Administration advisory board recommended a third dose of the Pfizer coronavirus vaccine for people aged 65 and older and some high-risk people. Also last week, a new Des Moines Register MediaCom Iowa poll, released yesterday, shows Governor Reynolds' job approval rating has gone up since June. 53% approve of the job she's doing, 43% disapprove, and the rest don't know what they think. Still in the world of Iowa politics last week, the Nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency released its first set of possible redistricting maps for state legislative and congressional boundaries. The maps are the opening salvo in what could become a long back and forth between the state legislature and the agency. The public will get a chance to weigh in at virtual meetings that run today, tomorrow, and Wednesday. After that, lawmakers will convene a special session to give the proposed set of maps an up or down vote. They cannot propose their own changes. If they reject the maps, the Legislative Services Agency has 35 days to draft a new set. Laura Bellin and I will dive deep into the new proposed maps tonight at 7 on KHOI's Capital Week. Also last week, Republican Mike Bussolo won a special election for the State House, keeping that district under GOP control. Bussolo defeated Democrat Andrea Phillips 52-48% in District 37 in Ankeny. The election was called after the death of Representative John Landon, who died in July. The district includes Ankeny and much of rural Polk County. Bussolo is a former advisor and chief of staff to former Governor Terry Branstad. Meanwhile, another special election will soon be held in Iowa, this one to replace State House member Wes Breckenridge. The Democrat from Newton resigned last week. Governor Reynolds announced that a special election will be held for the District 29 seat on October 12th. That district is in Jasper County. Also last week, Iowa Democratic Attorney General Tom Miller said he would run for his 11th term in office next year. Miller has held the job for 40 years, longer than any other state attorney general in the nation. And last week, the Linn and Clinton County auditors, both Democrats, announced they would run for the Iowa Secretary of State office next year. Linn County Auditor Joel Miller and Clinton County Auditor Eric Van Lanker both announced they'd run. Current Secretary of State Paul Pate, a Republican, has not said whether he will seek a fourth term. And Jill Biden came to Iowa last week. The First Lady went to the Des Moines Area Community College campus in Ankeny to stump for President Biden's $3.5 trillion spending package. She said it would help poor and middle-class families pay expenses. In other news last week, there was word that Iowa might receive nearly 700 refugees from Afghanistan from the first group of arrivals that will be resettled in the United States. They could be settled in the Des Moines and Cedar Rapids metros. Also last week, the Des Moines Register reported that allegations about potential mishandling of hazardous materials at a FedEx facility near Des Moines had raised safety and environmental questions and sparked a state investigation. State inspectors started looking into the FedEx freight hub in July. That investigation is based on an employee complaint that the company had not provided proper personal protective equipment to workers after an acid spill. On the court beat last week, a second inmate who admitted killing two Anamosa prison employees during an escape attempt pleaded guilty and was sentenced to life in prison. Michael Dutcher admitted his role in the killings of prison nurse Lorena Schulte and correctional officer Robert McFarland. Fellow inmate Thomas Woodard Jr. had pleaded guilty last month and had also been sentenced to life in prison. Also last week, a federal appellate court partially revived a lawsuit by California Republican Congressman Devin Nunes. That lawsuit alleges that an Esquire magazine article told defamatory lies about the family's Iowa dairy farm. Nunes sued Hearst Media and reporter Ryan Lizza for defamation over the 2018 article, which documented that the Nunes family had moved their dairy operation from California to northwest Iowa. Lizza suggested Nunes had tried to keep this secret because the farm employed undocumented workers. In another case, a judge ruled that the Des Moines Public School District did not have a special obligation to protect a student who was attacked and injured by peers at a school dance 2 years ago. Christy Mitchell had sued the district after her then 15-year-old daughter was attacked at the Roosevelt High School homecoming dance. There, she was set upon by three other girls. Mitchell's daughter attended Ankeny schools, but went to the Roosevelt dance with a friend. The Des Moines district said Iowa federal courts had refused to find that a duty exists between an educational institution and a non-student who enters the boundaries of its campus. The judge agreed. Meanwhile, last week, word that Iowa State University had suspended crew club activities 6 months after two students had died in a fatal boating accident. ISU conducted two investigations into the accident at Little Wall Lake, which is about 20 miles north of the university campus. Those investigations found that ISU did not have adequate oversight over its sport clubs and that crew club members failed to follow safety procedures that were in the club's own governing document. 19-year-old Derek Nani and 20-year-old Yaakov Ben David died when their boat capsized during practice at Little Wall Lake. Three other crew club members were rescued and survived. The crew club will be suspended for at least the rest of this academic school year while health and safety measures are adopted. Also last week, the Iowa Board of Regents approved a request to increase state aid by $15 million for the three state public universities. Meanwhile, word last week that U.S. News and World Report was out with its annual rankings of colleges and universities. Those rankings are determined by a complicated system of factors, including graduation and retention rates, peer assessment surveys, class size, and faculty pay. The University of Iowa ranked 33rd among public universities in the nation. Iowa State University ranked 58th among all public universities. And the University of Northern Iowa ranked 19th among regional universities in the Midwest. There was also a report last week that the state of Iowa lost more than 7 million trees in cities and farms last year when the derecho windstorm swept across much of the state. Cedar Rapids, Des Moines, and Davenport suffered the biggest tree losses, according to a new report from the State Department of Natural Resources. Iowa cities lost about 4.5 million trees, while rural lands lost nearly 3 million. Ames and Story County were said to have lost 250,000 trees. On the job front last week, word that Iowa's unemployment rate remained at 4.1% last month, compared with the national jobless rate of 5.2%. Iowa's jobless rate was tied with Indiana as the 17th lowest in the nation. And the principal financial group announced it would lay off some Des Moines workers as the company closes some of its lines of business. Principal issued a notice to the state announcing plans to cut 25 positions by October 11th. And in the world of college football, Iowa style, Iowa State University smashed UNLV in Las Vegas 48-3 on Saturday night. The University of Iowa buried Kent State 30-7. And the University of Northern Iowa dominated St. Thomas 44-3. And that is your summary of a busy week of news from all around Iowa. I'm Dennis Hart, taking my leave now, but planning to return tonight at 7 on Capitol Week, when Laura Bellin and I will talk about what's been going on in Iowa politics. Then I'll pay a return visit to this same virtual seat on Local Talk on Friday morning, when I'll report on what makes news in Ames this week. I hope you can be here for all of it. In the meantime, have a great week.
That's Bill Stewart with Septemberism from his album Space Squid. This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host, Ursula Rudenberg. Thank you to Dennis Hart for the news summary, and good morning, and thank you for listening. As Dennis mentioned during the news, his news, last May, Governor Reynolds signed into law legislation forbidding school districts and local governments from having mask mandates. But this past Monday, a federal judge in the U.S. District Court issued a temporary restraining order against that law. The situation is still in flux. Governor Reynolds has reacted forcefully against this, but in light of this restraining order, some school districts in the area have already taken action, as Dennis mentioned. Last week, Des Moines School, Iowa's largest school district, along with Urbandale, West Des Moines, reinstated mask mandates, as did Ames. So let's talk for a few minutes about schools and the issue of the safety of our young ones. Or as Julie Saxton on KHOI's show Inside of the Mind would say, the kiddos. The judge's ruling did seem a bit confusing, especially since it is essentially a double negative. So KHOI's government reporters Laura Bellin and Dennis Hart clarified what happened during last week's Capitol Week here on KHOI. Here's an excerpt of what they said.
A federal judge temporarily blocked the enforcement of Iowa's ban on mask mandates. That decision gives Iowa school districts the power to enact mandates on masks. Now, you know that in May, Governor Reynolds had signed the law that banned school districts and local governments from issuing mask mandates. She has reacted vigorously and negatively to this court decision.
First, I want to be clear. There are two lawsuits, so it can be a little bit confusing for people. So one was filed by Fran Parr. She's a mom of twins in Council Bluffs. She filed suit in state court trying to get this law that bans mask mandates in schools struck down because she says it's not safe for her to send her children to school. The other lawsuit was filed by the ACLU of Iowa. They were representing 11 families with children with disabilities and also the ARC of Iowa, which is a disability advocacy group. And this was a federal lawsuit, and it's grounded in federal law. So the Americans with Disabilities Act, the Rehabilitation Act of 1973, which guaranteed equal access to education for children with disabilities. And also they were claiming that the American Rescue Plan, which is the latest COVID relief, they were claiming that that also requires schools to be able to implement the best procedures to try to limit the spread of coronavirus. So on Friday morning, there was a hearing in federal court, and that's the ruling where Judge Robert Pratt ruled that he is temporarily blocking enforcement of that law. He did not rule on the merits yet, so we don't know how the final case will turn out, but he determined that it was likely that the plaintiffs would succeed on the merits in showing that the state law banning mask mandates in schools violates the Americans with Disabilities Act and Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act. If you've ever heard of a Section 504 plan, a lot of kids with special needs have those in schools, and that comes from this 1973 federal law. So right now, the law is on hold. And the governor's statement confused the issue a little bit because she said the judge overturned the law. He didn't overturn it yet. There hasn't been a ruling on the merits. He just blocked it from being enforced. So for right now, Iowa school districts can go back to making their own decisions.
The governor vowed on Monday to appeal the rulings. So she is vowing to appeal this.
The appeal would go to the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals for Iowa. That's the part of the federal circuit courts that Iowa belongs to. So a panel of circuit court judges would hear this decision and at some point could decide whether to reverse the lower court judge on the temporary injunction or not.
All of this is taking place in the context of the most recent coronavirus results in Iowa. 9,000 new confirmed cases of the virus in the state in the past week. That is up from the 8,000 plus that had been recorded for a couple of weeks. And the Washington Post is reporting that the state's 7-day positivity rate now has jumped to 12.2%. That is the highest by far it has been in a long time.
Yes. And when the positivity rate is that high, that's the percent of people who are getting tested who are coming back positive. What that really tells you is that we're not testing enough. I mean, if we were testing, and it tells you that the incidence of the virus in the population is very high, high level of community spread. But 1,000 new cases a day is a lot. And Judge Pratt, in his decision, one thing that made an impression on him at the Friday hearing, it was in the plaintiff's briefs in this, they mentioned that even though the schools have only been open for about 2 weeks in Iowa at the time that they were arguing this case, the number of cases of coronavirus cases in the schools is very high. So, for instance, in the Des Moines Public Schools, just in the first 2 weeks of the school year, they had as many positive cases as like 25% of all of the cases from all of the last school year. And in the Waterloo School District, it was more like 50%. Like they had of all of the cases during the last academic year, they've now had half that many just in the first 2 weeks. And so that tells you how transmissible the Delta variant is. And it also tells you what a difference it makes when you don't have a mask mandate in schools. And was partly that played into the judge's ruling on why these plaintiffs, who are the children with disabilities, would suffer irreparable harm. Either they would be in a classroom where they could get a life-threatening infection, or they have to be at home and remote learning. They're losing out on their educational opportunities.
And that was Laura Bell and Dennis Hart on KJY's Capital Week. You can hear them every Monday night at 7 p.m. or Wednesday at noon. And from what I heard Dennis say this morning, he certainly promises to go into the mask issue more tonight as things progress. Laura explained that the courts and rulings were based in federal law, including the Rehabilitation Act of 1973 and the American Disabilities Act and the American Rescue Plan. I took this opportunity to invite John Michelson to join us to explain these, especially the Rehabilitation Act of 1973 and the American Disability Act. These are laws that can end up helping all of us. Disability is a universal liability, and yet most of us only have a vague understanding of what these laws are. I couldn't tell you myself exactly what they do if you asked me. John Michelson is a member of Able Up Iowa, a nonprofit financial assistance program for disability and a longtime advocate for the disabled. Thank you for joining us, John, and thank you also, Anna Magnuson, director of Able Up Iowa, for joining us to help us understand what these laws actually are. So, John, thank you for joining us.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you, Anna, for joining us as well.
I'm glad that John is here to explain it. I'm to KHOI a lot. I would just say that as the state of Iowa, our very own former Senator Tom Harkin works tirelessly to advocate for people with disabilities to make sure that they have access. So this is something that's close to our heart at Able Up Iowa. And John Michelson has been a longtime advocate for people with disabilities. He's an advocate for veterans. So I thought he could share a little bit about his thoughts about these two laws. So, John, all yours.
Well, the Rehab Act of 73 was actually a civil rights act. It was the first law to address equal access to employment for persons with disabilities. So the various sections, you know, provide the standards that have to be upheld. Section 501 looks at, you know, what do we need to do to protect persons with disabilities that hold federal programming jobs, like building the EEOC, the Equal Opportunities Commission. 502 is an access. 503 covers federal contractors to the same standards as federal employees. 504 covers any other program receiving federal money. This is where we get into education. And then 508 gets into IT, computers. Is it accessible? If you have a website, you know, can the person with limited vision understand all the visuals on your web page? Can a person with a hearing deficiency be able to get all the context from the reading and provide the tools to remedy those situations?
John, before you get to the ADA Act, I just have a question about the Rehabilitation Act of 1973. You were saying that it applies mostly to employment. So what is the connection here to schools? Is it because you need to go to school to get jobs? Or
under 504, you are using federal money to get an education. That not all of the funding for school comes from state and local taxes. That there is federal funds for the buildings themselves and for some of the programs that they run. So they all must meet that accessibility standard.
So
the ADA goes on to define what those standards are.
Okay. All right. Go ahead then.
So they work well in concert. Again, it's the enforceable standards and accessible design. And Title II is going to look at state and local government functions like schools or public transportation. Title III looks at business and nonprofits. Can a person with a disability access your product or service? Can they work in your office or your job site? And if not, what accommodations can you make to make their learning or working equal to the others in that area? So again, looking at school children, they have to be able to get into a building. If it's got stairs, they need a way, if they have a mobility issue, to get upstairs, whether that's an elevator or a ramp. I would think in a pandemic, it would put the onus on schools to provide masks as a safety measure, that all students would have that.
Okay, thank you. So tell me if I'm summarizing correctly what you're saying, that the Rehabilitation Act of 1973 essentially, in this case, in the case that we're talking about here, stipulates that any service receiving federal support has to be accessible to everyone, including the disabled, and the American Disability Act, in a sense, breaks that down into exactly what the access means. And that it sounds like this actually applies to nonprofits, whether they receive federal funds or not. Is that correct?
Correct.
Does that apply to private business as well?
Absolutely.
Uh-huh. So it basically, the ADA says across the board that any facility that's open to the public must be accessible to all people. Am I reading that correctly?
Right. That is correct. And, you know, a lot of companies pushed back and said, this is going to cost us a lot of money to change our front steps or to put in an automatic door. So the ADA allows that, you know, some structures remain, but the first time you do any remodeling, you bring the rest of the building up to standard.
Mm-hmm. So as someone who's been a longtime disability advocate, do you feel that the claim made by the ACLU during this case was legitimate?
The wearing of a mask, doctors have said even their respiratory patients can still wear masks. There is no disability that absolutely precludes a student from wearing a mask.
My question was that the ACLU claimed that the prohibition against masks was a problem, violated the Rehabilitation Act and the ADA. Do you think that was a legitimate claim?
It does not provide equal, safe access to equal education.
You're saying that you think their claim in court was correct?
Yes, that schools can protect their children and staff.
Uh-huh. Okay, well, thank you. John, thank you so much for speaking with us. John is a board member of the Able Up Iowa, which is a nonprofit financial assistance program for disabled. And Anna Magnuson is the executive director. Any last words from you, Anna?
Thank you so much to John and to Laura Bellin for doing a great job explaining both.
Yeah, and thank you so much. Thank you, John, for your explanation. And I'd like to bring two more people into the conversation and invite you to stay if you wish, although I know everybody has busy lives if you need to leave. Connie Ryan is the executive director of the Iowa Interfaith Alliance, and Kathleen Matthews is a parent of three children in school who's been in communication with Connie. Thank you for joining us, Connie and Kathleen.
Thank you for having us, Ursula.
Connie, I asked the ACLU of Iowa to comment on the situation, but since they and the ARC are in the legal process in the middle of it, neither of those groups wanted to appear to be campaigning or to interfere with the process. However, the Interfaith Alliance did issue a public statement on the matter titled, "Iowans Applaud Decision by Federal Judge to Block State Mask Mandate Ban in Schools." And again, all of this is sometimes a little complicated because we're dealing with double negatives here. But Connie, your statement was focused on the broad issue of public safety. Could you read that statement to us?
Certainly. What I said in the statement, and it is confusing, and I actually had the wrong title when I first started to write it, so I had to go back and read it again and make sure that I was saying it correctly. So it is confusing. It is about the decision that Judge Pratt put out last Monday, and we stated that U.S. District Court Judge Robert Pratt issued the temporary restraining order blocking the enforcement of the mask mandate ban based on the Republican-controlled 2021 Iowa legislature and signed by Governor Kim Reynolds. And then we go on to say that Judge Pratt rightfully put decision-making back in the hands of local elected officials and school districts across the state regarding mask mandates. The concerns of Iowa families negatively impacted by the new state law were heard, and a remedy was issued. This is how our fair courts work, especially when people's rights are at stake. And then we go on to say that we urge Interfaith Alliance of Iowa urges Governor Reynolds to set aside her political agenda and reconsider her position on the issue of masks in public schools. And we very much believe that this decision making on this issue and on many other issues are about local control and local elected officials being able to make the decisions that are best for the children and the educators and the community that are in their care.
So you're saying, in a sense, that you felt that the law forbidding mask mandates was an overreach?
It certainly was an overreach. That is without question in our minds. The legislature and the governor took away local control from elected officials at the local school board level, and we believe that it should have remained there. Every community is a little bit different. We know that COVID is surging and is impacting communities across the state. that looks different in different communities, and it looks different in different school districts. And so we believe the best people to make those decisions are at the ground level. And this is a public safety issue. It's a public health issue, and it should not be a political issue. When you have a pandemic, politics should be set aside, and you should be making decisions based on science and what is in the best interest of the people at hand. This court case is about children who have special needs, and their rights have been impacted because the governor and the legislature, the Republican-controlled legislature, decided to take that control away from officials at the local level.
I'm speaking with Connie Ryan, Executive Director of Interfaith Alliance of Iowa. Connie, it has to be said, actually, Story County is having a relatively low count of infection rate, where we seem to be one of the better counties in the state, as well as Johnson County. But you're located in Des Moines. Could you tell us just real briefly who the Alliance is so that somebody doesn't know who you are and what kind of feedback you're getting in Des Moines, which is really the largest school district?
So Interfaith Alliance of Iowa is a 25-year-old nonprofit organization. We're celebrating our 25th anniversary this year. And we were created out of a concern of particularly religious extremism and making sure that there was a progressive voice in the public square. So we work on a whole variety of issues that impact communities across the state. And our office is located in Des Moines, but we are a statewide organization. So in Des Moines is obviously the biggest school district in the state, has over 30,000 students, and I'm not sure how many staff and teachers and faculty. And so when you have that number of students in buildings that are busy and doing the work that they do and teaching our kids and class sizes that are large, doing everything that you can to make sure the children in your care that you are teaching and educating, doing everything that you can to make sure that they are safe, should be in the hands of people who are at the local level. And so when you take that away at the state level and want to make a one-size-fits-all decision, that places children in danger. It places educators in danger. It places staff in danger. And so we believe that the best decision-making happens at the local level for these kind of decisions because, as you just indicated, Ames is different than Des Moines, is different from Iowa City, is different from Algona, Iowa, is different from Albia. So let's let the elected officials make these decisions. And Des Moines obviously has indicated that they prefer to have a mask mandate because they are very focused on keeping the children and the young people and their staff healthy. Because how can they teach if they don't have enough teachers, if there are too many teachers out with COVID? So it's really critical in a district like Des Moines.
Well, Kathleen Matthews is a parent. Kathleen, where are you located?
I'm in the Des Moines School District.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. You have how many children in the schools?
I have three children in the Des Moines Public Schools. My youngest just started this year.
So share with us your thoughts as a parent. How is this all looking? This is really up close and personal for you.
Yes, it is very personal. You know, my husband and I, we felt a lot of trepidation going into the school year, knowing that masks weren't required. We had kept our children home for virtual learning all last year, and we knew that they needed to be back in person, not only for their academic well-being, but their social and emotional well-being. They needed to be back in school. So despite our concerns, we sent them back. You know, and just really right out of the gate, I will say that the vast majority of parents dropping kids off, teachers, students at our school were wearing masks, but a proportion weren't. And, you know, on the first day, our family practices gratitude each evening before dinner, and my two older children said, you know, I'm grateful to be back in school and that my teacher was wearing a mask. And then my youngest said, well, my teacher didn't always wear a mask. And my husband and I were a little concerned about how to even handle that because by the law, she had every right not to. My youngest has since told us that she does wear it more often. But within a week of school starting, we got notice that our youngest was exposed to COVID in the classroom. Thankfully, she tested negative, but it was stressful, and actually just last Friday, we got notified that our middle child was exposed to COVID in the classroom, and and found out it was Wednesday, the very day that BMTS enacted masks in schools, requiring masks. And so we were at least grateful for that. We know that they work. We teach our kids that wearing is caring, that wearing their masks is really less about protecting them than it is protecting vulnerable others. And so I think knowing that their role models, their teachers are consistently wearing masks, that their classmates are consistently wearing masks, it just reinforces that we're doing this for our community. So I'm quite glad about the temporary restraining order, and I'm just hoping that it sticks.
Your middle school child, has that child been tested yet for COVID?
It's my middle child. She's actually on her way to urgent care. So we were quarantined this weekend. We just got word on Friday, and we are keeping her home until we can get a rapid test done this morning.
So you don't know yet if she's been infected or not. How do you feel?
Stressed. I worry about, you know, my children, of course. I am somebody who works on probabilities and knows that they're at lower risk. But, of course, we worked very hard to protect our children for a year. I think a lot of sacrifices occurred over the past year. Missed birthday parties for them, you know, missed play dates, missed socialization. And now it seems like we've just reversed course so much and we're out in the public so much more than we have been. So we're concerned. We are grateful for Judge Pratt's ruling. I think these personal experiences just speak to the importance of doing everything we can to protect our kids and our educators and all the staff and our broader community. We know it has rippling effects. And like I said, we know that the reason our family, by and large, practices all the things you're supposed to do to prevent the spread is, you know, for our own health and safety, but really because we know it's for the health and safety of other folks who are more vulnerable.
Yeah, it's an interesting point you're making that this isn't, for you, it's not only about safety for your children, but it's about education, about public safety.
Yeah, I'm speaking with Connie. I found the messaging from our governor very off the mark that it's basically, I trust Iowa families to make the right decisions for themselves and their children. And this, out of any issue, is not about me and mine. You know, this is about our community and it's about others. And so that's the messaging we send in our family. It's not the messaging that's there across the board. So we're just trying to stick to that and keep our kids consistent with wearing their masks and doing what they need to do.
Well, thank you, Kathy Matthews, a parent in Des Moines. Thank you for coming on and taking the trouble to share your thoughts at a time which is clearly personally stressful in your family. So I really appreciate you sharing your thoughts. And I was also speaking with Connie Ryan, Executive Director of Iowa Interfaith Alliance. On the same day as the ruling, Monday, Des Moines did reinstate the mask mandate immediately. They have had it in place for the past year prior to the law. Dr. Thomas Ahart, superintendent of Des Moines Public Schools, said the court's decision to set aside Iowa's ban on school districts being able to protect children in our care is welcome news. As the COVID-19 pandemic continues to surge in Iowa, our families and staff have expressed their concerns about schools not being able to require minimum effective mitigation steps such as wearing masks in order to keep people healthy and safe. So appreciate being able to actually have a parent here on Local Talk today and share your personal thoughts. On Wednesday, Urbandale passed a mask mandate that will begin today for all Urbandale students and employees until Polk County moves into a, quote, moderate positivity rate. Polk County is currently experiencing high community transmission at 12.4%, according to CDC. On Thursday, West Des Moines also voted to require all students and staff to wear masks starting today. And on Wednesdays, the Ames School Board voted unanimously to reinstate the mask mandate for all teachers, staff, students, and visitors to school buildings. It also requires that for indoor extracurricular activities and athletic events as well. It is not required for outside events, although strongly encouraged. Gilbert School District voted unanimously in support of that non-mandate policy at a special meeting, stating that face mask wearing will continue to be encouraged but not required. Nevada and Boone districts told me they have not yet met to discuss this plan, but plan to. And I did not get a response from Ballard School District. I did attempt to get more extended statements from the school districts that have decided not to reinstate the mask mandate. but was not able to get any statements from them. I do not think that should be interpreted as avoidance on their part. I really do believe that it's more of a factor of how incredibly busy school districts are at this time. Before we take a break, I want to thank Connie Ryan, Interfaith Alliance Executive Director, Kathleen Matthews, parent in Des Moines, John Michelson, disability advocate, and Anna Magnuson, director of Able Up Iowa. Thank you all for joining me this morning to weigh in on this. This is Local Talk here on KHOI Community Radio. Good morning. I'm your host for the hour, Ursula Rudenberg. Thank you for listening. Starting this Thursday, Iowa State will participate for the third time in something called the International Climate Change Theater Action Initiative, which is a biennial worldwide series of short plays and performances that coincide with the United Nations Climate Change Conference. The ISU Theater's Climate Change Theater Action 2021 is going to be a touring production that will open on Thursday, September 23rd at 5:15 p.m. outside ISU's Parks Library. What makes this time special, according to them, is that it overlaps with the development of the Ames Climate Action Plan. So their performance has special focus this year as they hope to inspire you to get involved with the Climate Action Plan. Okay, I just said a lot, so I have three people here to explain all this. Vivian Cook is the Community Engagement Director for ISU's Theater and the Eco Theater Lab's Climate Change Theater Action 2021 event. And she's directed Climate Change Action Theater Action events in 2017 and 2019 and has focused her efforts this year on connecting with local partners to coordinate the event tour, the Climate Action Resource Fair, and community engagement. Piper Smith is a senior at the Performing Arts at ISU and is assistant directing the performance this year. And Valentine Chenoux is a sophomore in environmental science and performing arts at ISU, and she is the stage manager. So welcome, all of you. Thank you for coming to explain this event. It's a little bit hard for the beginner to wrap their head around. So, Vivian Cook, please describe what the performance is. What is the experience that we'll see when we go to it?
Yes. So hello, and thank you so much for having us this morning. And Yes, so this is an international event, and there are more than 200 groups around the world and over 33 countries participating in the event between now and December. So we're really excited to be participating in AIMS. And like you said, our focus for our event, our touring event this year, is on encouraging awareness of and engagement in the AIMS climate action planning process. So anyone who comes to any of our events will get to see a variety of short performances about climate change. Some of these are written by playwrights from around the world who submitted plays for the international initiative that we then got to choose some to perform in our own community. And a couple of them are written by MFA students in creative writing and environment right here in Ames. So we'll have a variety of short plays that will be fun to watch in all of our community spaces where we're performing. And then we will also have opportunities for community members to interact with representatives from local sustainability organizations, to talk with each other and us about the climate action planning process and how they envision a strong climate action in Ames, Iowa. And opportunities to see a local art exhibit as well called The Art of Climate Planning, which is a project by the Eco Theater Lab and funded by a City of Ames small art grant that features seven local artists and their climate action work.
Okay, so based on what you just said, this is what I'm visualizing. Tell me if I am and getting it. I'm visualizing a play I'm visualizing a stage with actors doing a series of short skits. And then and maybe some readings. And then I'm visualizing some booths nearby with organizations to talk to and an art exhibit in the vicinity of the stage. Did I get that right?
That is about right. Piper Valentine, if you want to jump in and clarify any further, but that's essentially it. And we'll be performing in outdoor community spaces, so people are also welcome to stop by for a little bit, watch a little bit of the show, talk to a few people if you want, and then you can go on your way if you need to. But our first performance is outdoors on ISU campus, but then we'll also be this weekend at the Farmers Market, at the Play Ames Imagine Your City Community Engagement Festival, at the Octagon Art Festival, and then next week on Sunday, then we'll be at outside of a public library.
Okay, and presumably you've got a website where these locations can be found, and you've got rain locations, I would assume?
Yes.
Okay, tell us.
For all the events that we are producing, there'll be a rain location, and then the community events we're participating in, they'll have a rain plan as well.
So what's the website?
The website is if you go to Iowa State University's theater website, then you'll be able to find climate change theater action pretty easily on there. And then it'll have a list of all of our touring dates, all of our partners, all the information that you need to know in order to get there.
Okay. And we'll also put a link to that on at our website, khoifm.org. Okay. So before we get into a little bit more detail about what's happening here in Ames, just a quick question. You said this is an international event. Who started all this?
This was started by a group of individuals from around the world who wanted to start an initiative like this. So our primary contact is one of the artistic directors named Chantal Bilodeau, and they coordinate all of the events and coordinate with all the participants all around the world. Like I said, right now there's more than 200 groups. So they're coordinating and making sure everybody has access to the plays and any other information and support that they need to make this happen.
And where are they located?
They were started. And Chantal is from Canada and is located in New York.
Okay.
Right now.
Okay, and one more quick question about the community part of it. You sent us a long list of partners, and I'm assuming that a lot of those are actually the venues for the performances. What groups are actually driving this performance? There's ISU Theater, and who else is really making this happen?
ISU Theater and the Eco Theater Lab and the MFA program in creative writing and environment are the primary partners making the event happen. And then we have, yes, lots of community partners that are all listed on our website who are contributing to publicity, to venues, and then we'll have lots of representatives from local sustainability organizations at our Climate Action Resource Fair. So it is a big community collaboration, lots of people working to make it happen.
Okay. Piper Smith is the assistant director. Piper, could you talk a little bit about the choosing of the performers and the writers and the rehearsal process, which I gather is a little bit untraditional?
Yeah, sure. So we started back when we had auditions just a few weeks ago. So our process has been really short and packed together. And at auditions, we pretty much chose people based on like their availability, since the really short time period we have to work with. We had to make sure we could do as much as possible in only a few weeks.
So you're involving the MFA program at Iowa State, right? The writing program?
Yeah, so two of the pieces that we chose, we started with, like, I think there's about 50 plays in the Climate Change Theater Action Initiative. And before I started to work on this, I believe Vivian and Dr. Menefee cut that down to about half. And then at one point that got cut down even less. And I and the cast, we all read those and chose what we thought were the best. But then the MFA program comes in because the writing class they have actually wrote two of the pieces that we're doing. And those are also particularly fun. So not only do we have these global pieces, pieces from people in Canada, the United States, even places in Africa, but there are also two pieces written by people in Ames.
That sounds it sounds exciting, like a real global voice. Valentine Chenu, what is your role in all this?
I'm just here to make sure everyone gets places on time. I've just been doing a lot of the organizing, making sure everybody knows what's going on, making sure everybody gets the material handed out to them with such a quick turnaround time. Memorizing lines is super important, and knowing what's going on and knowing where you need to be is very important. So I've just been trying to stay on top of that and make sure people know when and where they're going.
Well, I guess I have a question for all three of you. Finally, the Climate Action Plan in Ames is your main focus in some ways, or one of your goals. Could the three of you talk a little bit about that and how you feel this play connects to it and what your thoughts are on the Climate Action Plan here locally?
Yes. So, one, I think a lot of us participating on this project are very excited that the City of Ames is working to develop a Climate Action Plan, and we're excited that there are plans for an extensive community engagement period where not only us, but everyone in the Ames community and at the ISU community can give their input into what they want to see in the Climate Action Plan. And I think I'm very excited for a strong Climate Action Plan that promotes moving forward and really protecting not only our environment, but all of us here who are living in it, and how that kind of reverberates not only in our own community, but in the communities surrounding us. So I'm very excited for what's moving forward. And the Climate Action Plan isn't written yet. Everybody has the opportunity to participate in the development of it right now, which is very exciting as we're working on this project.
Do you feel that this theater piece that you're doing now is really a helpful tool for those of us who live here in Ames to
to kind of get involved with that or think about it or kind of know what to do?
Yes. The really cool thing about us doing this as a theater project is that we can tell the stories that are actually happening around the world and in our community so that people can actually see and envelop themselves within those ideas. So it feels way more immediate and real, because climate change is generally a very hard thing to connect with. Like, we all on some level know what's happening, but it's hard to see how that's actually affecting our lives.
Yeah.
And so by showing people that, especially along with this process, it gives them a chance to actually get involved in something that will make a change right away.
Well, thank you. I've been speaking with Vivian Cook, Piper Smith, and Valentin Chenoux, and they are producing the Climate Action Plan. Let me get the correct one. The International Climate Change Theater Action, which will be happening in the next few weeks. And we'll put a link on our website to where you can find those performances. And I think you guys really are embodying the concept, thinking globally and acting locally, right? Thank you so much for joining me this morning. And I'm going to have to rush off here. This has been Local Talk. Thank you for listening.